Hey guys, and welcome to episode 17 of Underrated, a podcast where we look at films we believe are underrated, generally disliked, or simply forgotten. I'm your host, Gabriel Green, and I'm with my co-host, James Hamrick. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, too. I was trying to think of some like clever character assignment, but if I'm Neville, it would make you either a girl, a mannequin, or a zombie, so I didn't go there.
Hey, Fred was... he was a good guy, I think.
Yeah, if I did, it would have been Fred, so...
gone too soon.
Yeah, definitely. All right, so today we are talking about I Am Legend. But before we get into that, have you seen any cool movies lately?
So last night I saw the comedy Dinner for Schmucks. It's the second time I'd seen it. And it's almost a frustrating movie for me because it's funny, but the potential for it to be hilarious is there. The cast is great. Steve Carell is hilarious. He can do so much in just the way he reacts to different things going on. Zach Galifianakis is hilarious in it. His super weird laugh that he does. I laugh out loud every single time I see it. But it does this thing that I hate it when comedies do, because I feel like it's them not really relying on their own script or their like the actors well enough, where they just throw something crazy into it. Like, you know, a movie will have maybe two of these in a typical comedy where it's like, uh-oh, the phones got switched. What's going to happen now? Or, uh-oh, this happened. This movie, like every other scene, something like that happens. Like, the phones get switched. He mixes up girls and accidentally tells the main character's girlfriend to go away because he thinks she's... like his old ex, and then all of a sudden he invites her again to this other dinner party, and then they have to go in that, like, it just constantly, every time something happens, uh-oh, look at what just...
manufactured drama kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. Every other scene has where Steve Carell's character does something that completely changes the direction of what's going on and adds another wrinkle in this, and I'm like, at this point, so many different things have happened. And the movie is trying to get you to like Steve Carell's character, and it mostly works because it's Steve Carell, and I absolutely love Steve Carell, and I think he's perfect comedic timing. At the same time, the movie is constantly undermining its attempt to like get you to like him because he legitimately screws up everything, almost irreversibly. And then they have him come and kind of like save the day in the end, and you're like, oh, this makes up for the, you know, God knows how much of cost and damage he's caused, and
kind of
just
like the
all
Office.
Except to be honest, I like Michael Scott better.
Okay,
but it still has, you know, it has its funny moments. There's a lot of good characters in it, and then forgot I also saw Sing Street again.
Okay,
because I went over to my parents and I was with my sister, and it was late, and we're gonna have to get up early the next morning. But I really wanted to watch it again because I liked it. And she's like, no, it's late. And I'm like, okay, well, let me just show you the trailer so that you'll know what movie it is. And I show her, and it's a really good trailer. And my plan worked because she's like, all right, that looks good. Let's watch it.
Was that a second or third time?
That was the second time for me, although I think she told me she's seen it three times now.
Oh, wow.
It's just such a feel-good movie. Like, it's a movie that, to me, if you enjoy just being happy watching a movie and having a good time, like, there's no way you can dislike it.
I need to go check that out.
Yeah, it's definitely the movie that surprised me the most this year, and it's actually one of my favorites of the year.
Cool. Is there anything else you want to mention?
It's been a slower week for me. I think that's about all I saw this week.
All right, I saw two. The first film was Maze Runner: The Scorched Trials, the second film in the Maze Runner series. And this is a franchise that I really enjoy. The books are decent. They kind of, like general YA, they build these crazy situations to throw kids into. But also, like most YA, they don't really think ahead about the reasons for these crazy situations. So once they actually start trying to explain, it gets really stupid. And so, but I think what works about these films is the director, Wes Ball. Yeah, The Maze Runner was his first feature, and this one's his second one. And he is, like, right on the cusp of becoming, like, one of my top five directors just based on these two films. I love just how he directs these stories. Because most YA stories are really kind of overstuffed with all kinds of sappy drama and really just nonsense. But he's taken these stories and just stripped them back to like their bare essentials and just given us these characters and just completely thrown us into the stories. And he basically made these really lean thrillers. And they're basically chase films, especially this one, where they're kind of being chased across this completely deserted, I'm guessing it's somewhere in America, like Arizona, only slightly more desolate than Arizona already is. But yeah, so, and this, he makes actually a really interesting picture of the apocalypse. I mean, it's been done so many times before, but he's able to make a version that stands on its own. And then there are several incredible chase sequences involving these crazy zombie-like creatures where our characters are like running through abandoned malls and trying to get away from these. And also there's one where it takes place in a tower that's halfway fallen over onto another one. So the entire set is like diagonal and they're trying to run up the stairs. It reminded me a little bit of the sequence in Inception with the revolving hallway, just because everything's all cocksided. He just makes these action sequences where you just kind of forget to breathe because they're so intense and just all really well shot. And I think he mixes practical and CGI effects in a way that, I mean, even with like Marvel films that have like the best CGI, you can always tell that's CGI, that's not. And it's genuinely difficult to tell in these films, and they have modest budgets. I'm really, really interested to see where this guy goes. I hope he gets like a Mission Impossible or a Marvel film, because he could do an incredible job, I think. And he also, he keeps the focus on characters. This is a problem with so many action films where towards the end, they just kind of, the camera pulls way back and you see a CGI double running around and doing all kinds of crazy stuff and you completely lose your emotional connection. But he, like directors like J.J. Abrams, they keep the focus on the characters. Everything that happens, they always go back to the character's face. It keeps you invested every second of the action. And even if the story is really stupid, if you care about the characters, there's a lot you can do with a movie like that.
Yeah, I actually haven't seen either of them, and it's probably just the YA label that had like kept me from getting excited and seeing them. But I've heard from enough people that like, yeah, it's YA, but it's actually a good one. So
I wouldn't rank it necessarily with The Hunger Games. I think The Hunger Games has enough subtext that's actually like really good subtext about relevant issues to where I think it's better, but which is interesting because it's the same director as the film we're talking about today. But I think as far as just pure entertainment that is like really well crafted, I really like these. And I also saw Joss Whedon's Serenity. I was invited onto the Feelin' Film podcast with Aaron White to review it, and that was a really fun show. Aaron's got a great podcast going on over there, so definitely check it out if you get a chance. This is one of my favorite films of all time, and I think I talked about it on our top 10 review, a top 10 episode. So I'm not going to say too much, just that it's a fantastic sci-fi action film. Rewatching, I think this film has basically everything I ask of a movie. Great characters, great action, great story, relevant, important themes. I mean, there's like nothing that I want from an action film that isn't there. So, and every level, I think it really excels. But if you want to hear my full thoughts, go check out that episode on Feelin' Film. Is there anything else you want to mention before we move into our main topic?
No, I think I'm ready to start talking about this.
All right, let's move into our main review of I Am Legend. I Am Legend was released in 2007. It's based on the 1954 Richard Matheson novel of the same name. It was directed by Francis Lawrence on a budget of $150 million. It grossed $585 million, so a very solid performance. It stars Will Smith, Alice Braga, Charlie Tehan, and Emma Thompson, sort of. James, did you know this is actually the third adaptation of Richard Matheson's novel?
Yeah, I had seen The Last Man on Earth, I believe the Vincent Price version. My mom she loved TCM Turner Classic Movie Channel, and so that's how I know all of my older movies. That's where I got all of my info from them. I used to watch those all the time. And that was one of them. They would play, I think it was every Friday night, they'd play like an old school horror movie. And that was one of them. And I remember really enjoying that one, though it's been probably over a decade since I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the only other one that I had seen.
Yeah, I kind of looked up a bunch of facts about the films last night. And this one, that film was actually one of the first films to have zombie-like antagonists. It actually was like a huge inspiration for the Night of the Living Dead. And you actually look at some of the frames, they look almost identical the way the zombies move and whatnot. So it was interesting because it came a little bit before that. And from what I saw, it seemed to be the most faithful adaptation of the book. And then there was another adaptation in 1971 called Omega Man with Charlton Heston. I haven't seen that either, but they both have some pretty decent pedigree.
Yeah, I think it's kind of worth a revisit. I want to go back and see, because I also kind of just started looking up facts about this movie and the book and other adaptations. And it did sound like, especially the Vincent Price version is the one that really stuck closest, though sounded like it. All of them seem to diverge from the way the book ends. And I'm actually, having gone back and like looked up things about the book, I think that the ending of the book is probably, just reading it, my favorite of any of the book or adaptations.
Really? Yeah, so I'm just going to call spoilers now for both the book and the films. You haven't read the book, have you?
I haven't read the book, no.
Yeah, I've read the book. This is one of those adaptations where I won't say it's completely unfaithful. It does take some of the same premise and ideas of what the character is, what he's doing. But story-wise, it's very different. Like, in the book, they are it's weird because there's like different factions of vampires in the book. Some are kind of intelligent, and others are like fully functional, like humans. And so the book ends essentially with the main character of Dr. Neville being arrested by the vampires and tried and executed because he spent all this time as kind of a Van Helsing trying to kill all the zombies during the daylight. Not the zombies, the vampires. And so now he is like the monster, and that is kind of like almost like a Twilight Zone episode, where the normal human being is now the monster, and the monsters are now inheriting the earth, kind of thing. Where like just basically humanity is obsolete, and now a new creature has taken over. It's interesting. I'm not sure how much I like it, or what its kind of philosophical implications are, but it is definitely interesting.
Yeah, I think it just. For me, the way it ended with him kind of thinking about the perception that they have of him and then him saying, I am legend. Like, it makes the title, if anything, make a little bit more sense. Because I know with the ending of the film I Am Legend, they kind of try to work it in like, we are his legacy. This is his legend. Like, yeah, I don't buy that so much as...
Yeah, actually... Some of the story issues stood out with me a bit more this watching than it has in previous watching, so I'll get into that toward the end of the podcast. But for now, let's start out with what are some of your positives?
So my first positive, and I'm going to try to not cover, because I have three listed here, and two of them kind of tie back to just Will Smith. So to talk about, I guess, the two before talking about Will Smith is, what is the humor? I think this movie has a really good sense of humor for something that's so bleak. with his interaction with the mannequins and his interactions with the dog, and then even a little bit with the two survivors, there's a lot of really good comedic moments in this movie, and it almost made me think of, to a certain extent, The Martian, where it's just one character by himself, and he's in order to keep the audience engaged, the movie is doing a really good job of, like, injecting humor into it.
Yeah.
Like, having this main character be a likable and funny person so that we are interested and engaged with what he's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, though I think it's definitely a much more stripped-down and raw performance than Damon. I think Damon's fantastic in The Martian, but this guy isn't nearly as, like, witty or funny as Will Smith plays him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I got to second that. Will Smith is fantastic. I think he's been doing a lot more serious roles recently. He started out kind of like Tom Cruise, where he's very carefully crafting a public persona of his image. I've like listened to some interviews, essentially, where he would only take roles of really likable people, just so he could get a chance to show off his natural charisma as a leading man. And so, I think this is where he started to turn into much more of a dramatic actor. And I think this one is probably still my favorite of his dramatic performances. I mean, as you said, he's incredibly likable. You immediately connect with him, and you're willing to follow him through his daily routine because he feels like a real person. And he also, I loved how early in the film you see little hints of how he's slowly becoming unhinged and how his mental process is slowly wearing down. Like, this little ticks here and there are just kind of weird. And I really like that. And I think it's a very subtle performance. And then you have moments like in the dark where he has like complete terror and you completely buy it. So I think he really grounds this entire movie and he's the main reason I want to come back and watch it over and over again.
Yeah, I think I'm really glad that he's decided to start branching out and taking on more dramatic performances, because I think he's a phenomenal actor. He is so good in everything he's in. I mean, he was the best thing about Suicide Squad, in my opinion. And mm-hmm. I think my favorite dramatic performance from him is probably still Pursuit of Happiness, because like I cry in that movie every single time I watch it. But
yeah, he's good there.
For this though, like he does, like you said, ground this movie. Every scene in which it's just him, which is most of the movie, there's something about his performance that causes you to be engaged with what's going on. And the other thing that I had listed, other than just the humor that kind of tied back to him, was the intensity of the movie. There's some scenes that do a really good job of like putting the audience on the edge of their seat. And I think a lot of that is the directing and just what's going on. But if you have a guy who's kind of overacting or not acting enough or something, it's going to not really work that well. But that scene where he chases Sam the dog into the dark and he looks at Sam, and who's clearly looking at something else, and you kind of have that slow take where he kind of realizes what's going on. I feel like an actor may just like get real wide-eyed and just kind of oversell the terror, but for him you see the moment of realization on his face and the slow turn. Like I've already seen this movie several times and I just kind of like, oh man, I remember this part. This is good. Like, and so, yeah, everything that Will Smith does in this movie, I think, works really well, whether it's the comedic moments, the moments where he's just expressing sheer terror, the dramatic moments. He is the best thing about the film.
Yeah, I'm coming to really like Francis Lawrence as a director. It's he's not very well known. He doesn't have a very distinctive style. Like, I've seen most of his films, but what's consistent is that they're all well-crafted films with just solid directorial choices throughout. And this one is no exception. I think in that scene where he runs after the dog, well, going back before that, what I love is he gives us a full 30 minutes of this film before we even see, or I'm pretty sure even mention the dark seekers or the vampires or whatever they are. It's just kind of, we're just seeing Will Smith go through his daily routine, but obviously something's wrong. We're in an empty city. And like then you have the night where he's like slowly closing all the windows to that really upbeat Bob Marley song. And then he closes the last one and it cuts to silence. And then you have that slow pan where we see him like curled up in the tub with his dog and the gun. And you hear just the screams outside, and you see his like face twitching. So you, the film shows you like through completely visual language that this world is not right. Even though he spends his day relatively normally, he goes around, he scavenges, and he's fairly upbeat. There's something really wrong here. And then it's kind of out of the blue where the dog just runs into the building chasing a deer, and then the tone of the film completely changes. It turns into a straight up horror movie, where you like I love. Will Smith's acting here. And I think Francis Lawrence, he wisely chose, he kind of changes his style to fit the actor and fit the actor's strengths, where he shot most of that scene directly into Smith's face as he's going through the building with only the flashlight. So we just see his face, his terror, and there's no music. It's all just really great sound design and breathing as you slowly go through the building, and we can't see anything more than he does. And it's just a fantastic sequence of tension. It scares me every time. I've seen this film over a half dozen times, and I'm still completely on edge and tight, and just tightening up as that scene's happening because of how brilliantly Lawrence directed it. Have you seen any of his other films?
Yeah, so I haven't seen Constantine. I know that's one of his bigger ones. I've seen all of his Hunger Games, and I'm actually, I loved Catching Fire. Mockingjay Part 1, I believe, was the least well-received of them all, but that was actually mm-hmm. my favorite.
I really like that one, too.
I wasn't a huge fan of Part 2, but...
Really? Why not?
Do what?
Was it because of the story or the execution?
For me, it felt very anticlimactic as a whole and the actual climax of it.
Hmm.
I feel like maybe a lot of it is because of how much I liked Part 1, because I feel like Part 1 felt like it was building to something. Part 1 felt epic. You know, we've gotten past like the gladiator portions, and now there's almost like an army of districts amassing. And then Part 2 is just kind of like, here's a handful of people doing like different individual things in the city. And it's all like, everything's well done. Nothing's necessarily like poorly executed. I just feel like it didn't capitalize on Part 1 leading into this finale as well as it could have. And then I really am not a fan at all of the film's own climax, in that we don't even really see it happen. Like, we're building to something, and then it happens, and then we get about 20 minutes of falling action.
Have you read the book?
I have not read the book, so okay. Maybe it was just he did a faithful job, and there's not really a lot you can do.
I can understand that. I think the last book is very much a anti-war allegory. So I think in not making it triumphant and focusing on the grit and the grime and the dirt and just the horror of what's happening, I think he did a great job of capturing the spirit of the book. But I do understand if you were looking for kind of a triumphant fall to the capital. Yeah, it doesn't give you that. All right. Well, back to I Am Legend. I've seen Constantine. I enjoy that one. I think the story is a complete mess, but Keanu Reeves is great, and it's a really enjoyable film. And I think just France. I hope he gets more work, because I think he's a very dependable filmmaker. That there's always just something, just from a filmmaking standpoint, something interesting going on. He's always trying to elevate the material he's working with. And I really respect that.
Yeah, something that I really liked about this movie was like just the overall look and feel of this post-apocalyptic world. It felt very believable. And kind of to get to what you were saying, was this movie tells us a lot in just visual cues. So we have this initial thing with Emma Thompson, who is in this movie for... I mean, I really don't know why. I think, she's really great for the minute of screen time that she has. But it's just weird that you get Emma Thompson for a minute. But, we're told about this supposed cure for cancer and all this stuff. And then it cuts to, modern day New York 3 years later. And it's overgrown. And through that, we're not told, oh, and then this time this happened. And then this is when this happened. It's all being fed to us just through what New York looks like, the current state of everything in it. It's all very believable. We get a few flashbacks that, help fill in the missing pieces. But overall, it does a really good job of not relying on, just heavy exposition in dialogue, but just really setting us into this world and putting enough detail into the world that you don't need a lot of that exposition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like how he slowly teases out Neville's backstory. And I can't tell you how happy I am that, you know, he didn't go for the cliched really sweet moment between Neville and his wife. Like, most of the flashbacks, they go back to a really intimate moment. But this was, it was a piece of action, essentially, where they're both highly stressed, and, you know, they're talking, and then the hints about what's happening is interspersed in their dialogue. And, like, and you, like, the kid's whining in the backseat, one of them kind of yells at her. It feels like a real scene from anyone who's been part of a family. Like a real scene between a husband and wife in a highly stressed situation. And that way you don't realize that, oh yeah, I am getting exposition. This is all just kind of emotional heart-tugging to get me to feel about the character. But it's done so well that you don't notice that you're being manipulated in that way. And it also just feels real to how characters act in these situations.
Yeah, I think exposition done well is the kind where you don't notice that that's what you just got. Pretty much what you said, like, we were just given, within just their conversation, a lot of information about what's going on, and yet it never felt like, you know, Neville was never saying, honey, I was working on this, and now this has gotten out of hand, and now we are doing this. It was a legitimate conversation. Yeah, so that's not noticing that you have just been fed a lot of information about the story, I think is a really strong thing that the movie has working for it, is that we are given exposition through by way of the look of what's going on, as well as these conversations that feel real. It never feels like these characters are talking to an audience. You know, why would this character need to know something that they probably already know? Well, the reason they said this was because the audience doesn't know. You know, we never get that in this movie, and I think that's a really good thing.
Yeah. They act like the world is already fully functioned. Like, in that conversation, Will Smith's character is the one that's really hesitant to give her information. She's the one kind of pressing him, because she actually doesn't know. And it's that kind of classified information. He doesn't want to give it to her, kind of thing. So what's another thing you liked?
One of the other things that I liked about the movie was the structure of the first half of this movie. I think most of my issues probably come in to the second half, but I think the first half of this movie really has very little to take issue with. And I hate it when the dog dies. That doesn't even need to happen. I've never been one to really get mad at a movie for killing a character that I like or for ending in a depressing way. You know, I don't think every movie needs to end in have a happy ending. As long as the movie's done well, I'm probably still going to enjoy it. But for this, it's like, man, you didn't have to kill the dog. Why do you do that to me? But I really like the way the first half of the film plays out, where it's just him and his dog, and they're going through New York, and we're seeing his life. It's just the way one seed feeds into the next one, and then the way that one leads into the next one. It has a really nice natural flow. And I like that kind of film where it's just one guy plus the side character being his dog, just living in this world and explaining this world to us. It felt, everything about it, the editing, the pacing, it all felt really tightly done. I think the moment that I think maybe some of my problems started coming in was after the trap was laid for him. I love that scene of him seeing Fred out where he shouldn't be, because it's a really funny scene, and yet whenever he first drives by and you hear the music and you see Fred out there, like, I almost got like goosebumps, because you realize, like, oh my goodness, is there other people? Are these vampire things somehow getting more intelligent? And so that whole scene was incredibly dramatic and done really well. But I think after that, the feel of the movie kind of changes after that, and that's where some of my problems come into play. But for the most part, this first half of the movie is almost flawlessly done, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I love that scene. I think it also works well as a very stark transition point from the second to the third act, to where or I'm not even sure if you can separate this film into three acts. It might just be actually two acts. But yeah, so I think that scene, it works well as a transition, because where he's had up till then, you've had your rocky moments, but he's had his daily routine and everything's all hunky-dory as well as it can be. And then that's where everything starts to, you know, crumble and go to hell. And I about the scene, I think that would probably be in my top five, like, all-time Will Smith moments, where he's just standing in the middle of the street with a machine gun screaming at the top of his lungs at a mannequin. Just, what are you doing out here, Fred? It is kind of funny, but it's also, that is where you realize just how much being alone has affected him as a character. Well, being alone and everyone else in the world wants to eat you. It's kind of messed up his psyche. And so then when the trap is laid, you realize, oh crap, these things are smart now. And like, they bring out the, he brings out the dogs. And I don't mind the fact that they killed the dog. I think it was necessary to put Neville where he ends up. And I think with the film's, you know, theme of providence, I don't think it's terribly well handled, but I think to get Neville to break, you need to take away his one stability. And then that leads into when he meets directly into meeting the people. And then, you know, the whole devolution into the end where everything falls apart. I think it was necessary to take away that one last bit of security that he had. And as a scene, I mean, I love dogs. I already love dogs. So I was completely on board with having Sam as a main character in the film. And another thing I liked is that the film doesn't try to make the dog excessively smart or have some kind of special characteristic. She's just a dog. She acts like a dog. She does stupid things like dogs do. And their friendship or whatever feels really real, and it's quite adorable. And so when they finally comes where she saves his life and gets infected, and, you know, he rushes back to the lab and tries to save her, and you have it's just this incredible scene. I mean, it's horrible. It's incredible. Where he's like kind of singing her and rocking her. And then he slowly, like, his singing kind of slowly tapers off as he's checking for these signs that she's probably turning. And then she starts growling. And then she's like lunging at him. And as he's strangling her, the camera just focuses on his face. And Will Smith does incredible acting right there. It's just like, you feel every bit of suffering and sadness that he feels right there, just watching him. And yeah, so it's a horrible scene, and it definitely hurts you. But I do think it was necessary for the film, and as a piece of filmmaking, I think it works really well.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not an objective criticism. And really, it's not even a subjective criticism. I don't even dislike that the movie did it, I guess. If anything, it's a positive, because it did exactly what it intended to do, which was make me incredibly, incredibly sad. Yeah. So it served the movie well in that. And I mean, I do agree with you that it was kind of necessary to get the character of Neville to the place that the film needed him to be. So yeah, it was well done. I just hate it.
There's a couple last things that I want to mention before we move into our dislikes. Is I love, as you talk about the first half of the film where he's going about his routine, and there's just little moments here and they're like playing golf off the wing of a Blackbird jet or something, and or hunting out of a sports car. I mean, just because you can do that, so why not? It's just awesome moments like that. And I'm sure you noticed the Batman Superman poster.
Oh yeah, the movie knew things,
which is crazy because the color's different, but it's still pretty much the same poster that they actually used for Batman vs. Superman.
Yeah, this movie was being made before we all knew about it.
Yeah, and it's Warner Brothers, I believe. I believe it's Warner Brothers, so that makes sense. All right, and also, this movie introduced me to Bob Marley, so that's another good thing.
Yeah,
I love that song. The song he plays throughout, the Three Little Birds one.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that's a big positive. Oh, and did you know this was shot by Andrew Lesney?
I did not notice that.
The Lord of the Rings and Hobbit cinematographer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, the film is, I think it's shot really well, so that makes sense.
Yeah, it's definitely a great looking film, and he's definitely going to be missed.
Yeah, I remember hearing when he had passed away, just happy that at least he was able to get his Oscar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's crazy because like, usually you don't hear much about cinematographers, but having spent, I don't know, countless untold hours poring over the Hobbit special features, you feel like you get to know the entire crew, even like these side jobs, and yeah, it definitely did hit me when he died. All right, if you don't have any more positives, let's move into our dislikes. What were some of the dislikes you had?
So the most visibly apparent one, and this is one that a lot of other people had as well, was sometimes the CGI is not always great in this movie.
Yeah.
It's hard for me. I almost had the same problem I did with iRobot, where it's hard for me to try to think about what other movies came out at the same time, because I don't want to judge the CGI by today's standards, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's not, you know, I'm not super aware of what all the other, like, CGI heavy movies of 2007 were.
This would have been a year before Iron Man. iRobot would have been 2 years before this, so.
Okay. See,
it was still in the iffy phase.
Yeah.
Or it's still in the iffy phase, but it was even more iffy back then.
Yeah. Cause, I mean, Iron Man is an amazing looking movie, considering his suit is CGI for the majority of that film. But yeah, so the scene where he's hunting and the animals had that clear kind of, just, I guess the way the texture, something about it just looked very obviously like it wasn't real. And
yeah. Which is, there's a lot of movies that have CGI. I've seen a lot of CGI deer. I've never seen a good one. They always look terrible when they try to make deer with CGI in film.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it is about it that just makes it so difficult. I think The Hobbit had some CGI deer, and I think it looked pretty good for the most part.
Yeah, it's the white stag.
The white stag, yeah.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen the first one.
But yeah, and when the lions walk up, it just, you know, like I said, maybe it was good for the time, but watching it now, it really felt off. And then the Dark Seekers, I think the designs of them, like just in terms of their actual aesthetic design, is fine, but it was really obvious that they were CGI.
Yeah.
Just the way they moved, the texture of the skin, like even their eyes. There was just a lot of things about them that was, I think, not poorly done, but could have been done better, especially mm-hmm. since they are like the antagonists of the film. You want them to be really scary. I think the scene where you really don't see them super well, the first scene that you see them, that's when they work best. Whenever Will Smith is in the dark and he just has his flashlight and you're seeing him in these small glimpses. But as the movie goes on and we're just consistently seeing them, like, without any sort of hindrance in our view, they work less well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think design-wise, and the sounds they make are really, really terrifying. The CGI, I think as far as motion capture work, it's okay for the time period, but it definitely stands out. There's one scene I'm remembering, though, where the alpha bad guy attacks him in the house. And I think that's really good CGI, where they're fighting each other. That's probably mostly practical. Like, there, I completely believed that was a real creature, like, biting onto his collarbone or whatever. For me, I have a hard time criticizing CGI because for every bad CGI thing, there's another awkward, bad practical effect. There's only so many. Sometimes you just have to go with it to tell the story you want to tell. And this one has crazy zombie things, and we don't have real zombies in the world that can run 30 miles an hour. So, I don't know. It is what it is. It's not a huge issue for me, but it is a little distracting in some of the scenes. I think maybe if they'd gone for a slightly more practical, though, some of the scenes would have had to be CGI either way. And they do give these creatures pretty absurd strength. Like where they can run and head ram into a car and knock it over the side and things like that, which are, or like essentially run up the side of a building, and just the human physique can't really do that. So
yeah, that was something that I was wondering. I was like, so does this give them like rabies like symptoms and superhuman strength? Because these guys are all like Olympic level gymnasts right now.
Yeah, it's I guess my biggest issue with the film is kind of, I'm not entirely sure what to do with it because I'm not a huge fan of the original Matheson ending. I don't like the idea of having humanity as obsolete and some other creature taking over. I'm not entirely sure I like that. And so you see that in this film, you see the hints throughout of the creatures becoming more evolved and more intelligent. Like they lay traps, they'll come out into sunlight for longer and things like that. Or like they'll like domesticate dogs or whatever. So you can see the film was sort of halfway trying to go for the ending. And there is an alternate ending that's on YouTube that shows in the alternate ending, everything happens basically the same until the very end where they all break into the house and they're trapped in the plexiglass lab. And he's banging on the door, cracking the glass. But in the alternate ending, like, essentially, the female vampire that he has been experimenting on has, like, a butterfly tattoo. And then the zombie guy does it, kind of, he smudges, like, a butterfly symbol on the glass. So essentially, I guess, communicating that all he really wants is his girlfriend. So Neville rolls her out, and they kind of hug. And he screams at Neville a bit, and they all leave. And then the ending is Neville and, what's her name? What's the girl's name?
I have IMDb. Let me go check.
Whatever. And then the end is them driving off. And then it cuts to black as they're driving. So even that isn't even committing to Matheson's original ending. In that, they're still kind of enemies, and they'll still probably fight, and who knows what's going to happen, because they're going to try to find a survivor's colony. So it's still, I think that is also thematically confused as far as to what's going to happen. What are these creatures? Are they actually intelligent? Are they still going to eat people? And it's also pretty inconsistent with how the film's treated them, because all the way up till now, and from all we can tell in the past, these creatures have spent all their time eating people. But now all of a sudden we're supposed to believe they're semi-intelligent and we should feel sorry for them. So that ending did not test well, so they reshot it to where instead he hides the girl, the woman and the boy.
Anna.
And then
Anna. Ethan are the names.
Yeah, Anna and Ethan. Where he hides them and then blows himself up and all the zombies so they won't see. And then the ending is her arriving at the survivor's colony. So it's a more hopeful where now we have the cure. People are still out there and now we can win. And I think that's also a little weird because we've had the signs of intelligence leading up to there. So I think both endings are a little thematically confused, both the alternate. And I used to really dislike the alternate ending, but now watching this time, I understood a bit more what he was going for, and I saw a bit more of the problems with the theatrical ending. So I really don't know what to make of that. I think both of them had their issues. I think I slightly prefer the theatrical ending, because I think it just fits the movie we've seen up till then. I think it fits it better, but it does feel just a little weird. Because of some of the hints that it just feels like there's some unrealized potential with where they were going with the Darkseekers before that. What do you think of that?
So, having not read the book, I just read, you know, a bunch of different synopsis and people's takes on the ending. I think the reason that I kind of like the ending in the book at least the way it's been presented to me, was I didn't really look at it so much as like a philosophical statement saying humans have become obsolete. Maybe it was. I don't know a lot about the author. But for me, I looked at it more of just like somebody having a crazy idea, like, man, what if I wrote a book like where humans became the legends and this new species looked at us like it just like this, like kind of what you said, this Twilight Zone idea. Because I know there was even an episode of the Twilight Zone where this woman is plagued by the small UFO. She's just this woman living on a farm, and when she hits the UFO down, come to find out that that tiny UFO was a US UFO, and she's some giant on this other world. So it's almost a similar idea to an episode that they've had before. So without really looking at it as if it was this message saying that we're becoming obsolete on the world, is more of just this really cool idea of humans becoming the ones, like the legends that the vampires will tell each other in the future. Like, that's a cool idea to me. And it fits the title of the book, I Am Legend. More so than I think the ending of this film fit that title, where Anna says, you know, we are Neville's legacy. This is his legend. I was like, that line was only because the movie is called I Am Legend. Like, he definitely saved you, but it I don't think it's going to be like the legend of Neville. It's like, oh yeah, Dr. Neville, he saved us. It's going to be like historically recorded, not necessarily a legend. And in regard to the two different endings of the movie, I'm not a huge fan of either. I think that I do kind of, like you, slightly prefer the theatrical version. I think that had things happened differently throughout the main course of the movie, I would have preferred the alternate ending. If the movie had been giving us more clues that maybe these vampires are more sophisticated than we thought, and kind of given us hints that they do continue some form of relationships with each other, then that at the end realizing, oh, so I was wrong about them, would have been more impactful. But because prior to it, they just kind of seem like mindless things that are ramming their heads into cars and jumping over all sorts of crazy stuff and not necessarily acting like they have any sort of, you know, human reasoning. Because we didn't really see that before, I wouldn't have bought the alternate ending if they had made that the official ending. I'd be like, no, this kind of came out of nowhere. But then with the theatrical cut, first of all, like I get that he blows himself up, but it's still not made clear to me that that was enough to just make everything fine for Anna and Ethan to escape. Because last we checked, like there were lots of vampires out there, more than just that small room. That's a nitpick, but even with going beyond that in the theatrical cut, with them driving back, it seems weird because it seems so disconnected from the rest of the movie. For the majority of this movie, we're following Will Smith in New York, studying just him as this character, and with the ending being these two characters that have come in semi-recently, driving away in this like super hopeful and optimistic tone. The ending feels different somehow in terms of tone and obviously in terms of actors, because Will Smith's not there anymore, but it for whatever reason, I feel like it just doesn't flow well with the rest of the movie.
I guess forgetting the small glimmers of development that we've seen in these zombie creatures, such as like laying a trap and having dogs, I think if you could overlook that, I think the ending works well enough thematically, where you have the character who was a Christian before or some kind of believer in something, some kind of religion before the apocalypse, who's lost all faith. And then both alternate and original ending have something of a theme of providence in them. So to have these characters come in where he essentially gives them the cure he's found. He's been working for all this time by himself, and finally found the cure, and kind of giving them the cure and then sacrificing himself to save it. I think that that sort of works, and then where he says he's a legend, I think he does. I think he kind of would become a legend. You know, the lone virologist who worked for 3 years by himself in New York City, and finally found the cure all by himself without. I think that could become a legend. So, I think it does what it needs to do to make that a workable ending. It's not like a horrible thing where you just want to like throw your remote at the screen or something. But I think it definitely could have been better. So, yeah, I think both are flawed. But as a film, as it works, I think it works well enough. And me being an optimist, I like that humanity wins. So, it doesn't really bother me.
Yeah, it's definitely not a huge complaint. I wish that I liked the ending as much as I liked other parts of the movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not this huge deal for me.
Well, what did you think of the theme of like Providence? It reminded me a little bit of Signs, but I think Signs handles it better.
You pretty much just said exactly what I was going to use as my answer, was that I think Signs is a movie that handles this issue better. Because I think that a lot of people say that Signs is where Shyamalan started his downward spiral, and I argue against that.
I think it's his apex.
Yeah, I was about to say that's my favorite. I think in retrospect, you know, a lot of people say Sixth Sense. Some people say Unbreakable, but mostly it's Sixth Sense. I think that movie holds up far less well in retrospect as Signs does. I think the way Signs handles this idea that everything happens for a reason, things that seem tragic at the time are happening so that everything works out, I think it's done incredibly well in Signs. And it's a theme that you kind of see somewhat throughout, whereas this idea of providence, it doesn't really come into play until the very ending of I Am Legend. And
there are little hints here and there, like her making the butterfly sign or like handing him the dog and kind of things like that, but they don't call enough attention to themselves, and they don't happen often enough to properly set it up.
Yeah, and to me, it just seems like almost like this deus ex machina that comes out of nowhere, where it's...
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's exactly what it is, and those aren't always necessarily bad, but it just feels like she shows up, she's like, oh, I'm here for a reason, and then the movie ends... only probably like 30 minutes later. I'm not sure how much movie is left after Anna and Ethan show up and she says that, you know, I was told by God to come here. And it's not done poorly, certainly. But it's funny that we both think of the same movie, because I did instantly think of Signs, but this idea that everything happens for a reason. And to me, it's hard to not compare those whenever they're both handling similar ideas. And then when you do compare them, like I said, I just think Signs handles it far better.
All right. Did you have any more dislikes?
I think that's all I have listed here.
All right. So let's move into our final thoughts. You want to start?
Yeah. So I think that I Am Legend is overall a really well done film. I think the first half of it is essentially flawless. I think it's one of Will Smith's best performances in any film. And even though I have some issues with it, actually, that I didn't talk so much about, I also had some slight issues with the pacing, and I think it kind of loses momentum after Anna and Ethan show up. But that aside, I think with some of its issues in pacing, the fact that its ending isn't entirely satisfying, and some iffy CGI, I think the movie definitely has enough going for it to where it's definitely worth being called a really good movie, and it's worth a rewatch. Or if you have never seen it, it's definitely worth a watch.
Yeah, definitely. Like as you said, this is one of my favorite Will Smith movies, or at least performances. And I think Francis Lawrence, the director, just does such a wonderful job of creating this world. And then appropriately just focusing on the character, and the pacing is really patient. It's not boring, but it doesn't rush through things. We just get to kind of spend time with them. And so I think that just the film's use of tension overall, even even with the climax being a little iffy, I think it's still a pretty impressive sequence. Just as a blockbuster action set piece, I think it's really well done. I really like the sequence where it's kind of he's having his epiphany, and you just kind of hear in the background the guy keep banging into the glass and slowly cracking. I think it's a really well done scene. And so, just overall, it's a really solid, well crafted film with a great character, with a great performance from Will Smith, and a very good depiction of the apocalypse. And I didn't mention her before. I haven't mentioned her before, but Alice Braga as I forget, what was her name again?
Anna.
Anna. As Anna. I think she's good. I haven't seen her in anything else. I think she's in Elysium, but she hasn't been around much. And I think she's good for what she has. So yeah, just overall a very solid thriller with some elements that are of like pure greatness here and there. So yeah, if you haven't seen it and you've listened through all this way, definitely go check it out. It's definitely worth seeing. I think it is an underrated film in Will Smith's filmography.
And just to mention, it's also this also stars Willow Smith. I just think that's worth pointing out before
As his actual daughter.
Yeah. Also like Jaden Smith playing his son in Pursuit of Happiness.
Yeah, people will say, oh, that's a horrible nepotism. I think it's cute. It works.
Yeah.
They're both good in both those films, so why not?
If I was a dad, that's exactly what I'd do anyway, so.
Mm-hmm.
I just wouldn't do After Earth.
Have you seen that?
I have not seen it. I've seen more than trailers. I don't even know how, but I know I've seen extended scenes throughout, and they were enough to let me know that I don't plan on seeing it.
Yeah, it's not actively bad. It's just a straight fine. There's good stuff and just it just doesn't do much. But it's not like some other Shyamalan films that are like really terrible.
I really disliked what I saw from Jaden Smith. I think it most of his stuff just seems so forced and phoned in. Like he's pretending to be scared, and as an actor, you should look like he's, you're pretending.
He's good in some scenes, he's really awkward in other scenes, and I think he's a likable enough performer where it works, but his acting isn't terribly nuanced. All right, is there anything else at all you want to mention before we close?
I think that's about it.
All right, well, Christmas is coming up, so we're gonna do one of my favorite Christmas films of all time, Arthur Christmas. It's from Aardman Animation. I never hear about this movie. It's almost completely forgotten, but I think it's almost a masterpiece. And as I said, it's my favorite Christmas film. You haven't seen it, right?
I have not seen it.
Okay. So I think it's definitely underrated. It has like the best British cast ever with James McAvoy, Jim Broadbent, Bill Nighy, and Hugh Laurie. So it's a fantastic voice cast. And if you haven't seen it, definitely go watch it because I think it's a fantastic film. So that's going to be our Christmas episode coming up. I'm really looking forward to that. And so if you enjoy this podcast, I'd like to ask you to go and subscribe and rate and review us on iTunes. That would definitely help us. It'll boost us in the rankings. Just help people find us, and so we can kind of expand our reach. And also like us on Facebook. We're on Facebook as Underrated Podcast. We also have a website, theunderratedpodcast.com.
And if you want to follow us on Twitter, you can. We are underrated_pod. And we also have an email if you feel like emailing us any suggestions. We are theunderratedpodcast@gmail.com.
And feel free to interact with us on Facebook. We love interacting with you. And if you have any suggestions of films you believe are underrated that you wish that you'd like for us to review, definitely comment on them there. If we agree, we'll probably put an episode out on it. All right. And also, I am on Facebook as Gabriel Green. Feel free to shoot me a friend request. I love talking about film on there.
Yeah, I'm also on Facebook as James Hamrick, and same as Gabriel. I love talking about movies. So if you want to just talk about random movies or give me some suggestions, I'd love to continue to talk. So until next week, I have yet to see Arthur Christmas. I have high hopes for it, but I love me some Christmas movies, and I have my favorites. So we'll see how this one ranks. So until then, we will see you later.
See ya.